Almost every American family has received an important-looking letter which begins, "Dear Sir, you may already be the winner of $50,000 in prize money. What are your chances of winning the jackpot?" I'll return in a moment with the amazing facts about compound probability. Hello, this is Joe Cruz on the Amazing Facts broadcast, facts which affect you. Let me ask you a question today concerning the law of compound probability. How much of a chance would you have in winning some prize if you only had one chance in 84 with 100 zeros after it? Now, I can't pronounce the zillion or sextillion or whatever that figure would represent, but I can tell you one thing, friend. Your chances in that kind of situation might as well be called zero. Yet today I'm going to share with you the exciting news that one chance out of 84 with 100 ciphers actually did come to pass, and your very life depends on that incredible, unlikely circumstance. You see, in the Old Testament scriptures, there are 300 specific predictions concerning a Messiah who would be born to save the world. His birth, life, and death are dealt with in hundreds of instances by the major and minor prophets of the Bible. And yet, for all those prophecies to be fulfilled in the life of only one man, there wasn't one chance in all of these unpronounceable zeros that it could ever occur. Yet it did happen, and the one man who fulfilled all of the predictions was none other than Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whose life has influenced history more than any other man who's ever been born. Not only did he fulfill the hundreds of predictions concerning the Son of God, but he claimed to be the fulfillment. He spoke confidently of having all authority and power in heaven and earth. He professed to control completely the operations of nature. He claimed lordship over the angels, accepted the worship of men, and stated that he would be the final judge of the world. Now, admittedly, others have made similar claims at various times and places, but they were pushed aside as cranks or fools. Christ is the only person known to history who has claimed divinity and yet who's been accounted sane by the human race. The founders of other religious systems, such as Mohammedanism, Buddhism, and Hinduism, did not claim to be God incarnate. Here, Christianity differs from all other religions. Christ spoke and lived as a being whose dwelling place was eternity, and he alone of all mankind has convinced multitudes of all ages, races, and walks of life that his claims to divinity were genuine. Now, seekers for truth should not begin with secondary questions, such as difficulties in the Old Testament, or the origin of evil, the problem of pain, etc. The truth of Christianity stands or falls with the person of its founder. He believed his claim so implicitly that he was prepared to risk not only his own life, but the lives of his friends as they too advocated his gospel. He foretold that his followers would be persecuted and put to death. And yet he intimated also that such a fate was a light thing in comparison with the importance of establishing his sovereignty over the world. Christ's claims even survived the test of apparent failure. On the cross, after being rejected by his own nation and religious leaders, he could still behave as King of eternity, promising heaven to a penitent criminal and interceding as calmly for his enemies as though he were walking the pavements of a country town on a sunny day. Furthermore, it would appear that this man's deeds matched his words. No man ever acted as this man acted. Could one flaw be found in the fourfold narrative, the whole picture would be blemished and Christ's claim dissipated. But no such flaws exist. Had Christ never lived, it would have required his equal to invent the unique story of his life. Despite his insight into the nature of man and his understanding regarding truth and morality, he himself seemed never conscious of personal guilt. Here Jesus of Nazareth differed from all other good men. Thus it has been said of Christ that if he was good, then he was God, for good men do not lie regarding themselves. Now let's look at some of those uncanny predictions which identifies Jesus as the Savior of the world. I turn first to the psalmist, and we notice a few here in Psalm 55, verse 12. for it was not an enemy that reproached me, then I could have borne it. Neither was it he that hated me, that did magnify himself against me, then I would have hid myself from him. You know, friends, how it is in life today. If an enemy does you harm or some real disfavor, you expect that, and it's a lot easier to bear it. But when it's one of your closest friends, that's really what hurts. And so the prophecy goes on in Psalm 41:9 and says, "Yea, mine own familiar friend, in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, hath lifted up his heel against me." Now let me ask you something, friends. Was this fulfilled in the life of Jesus? Oh yes, you remember as you read the gospel story there in Matthew 26:50, when Judas led his delegation into the garden to where Jesus had just finished his prayer, Judas came up to Jesus and kissed him. We read that Jesus turned to him and said, "Friend, wherefore art thou come?" You see, Judas was his friend. Judas was one of the 12, one of his closest associates. He was the treasure of the group, and yet he was the one who betrayed him. Prophecy fulfilled. Zechariah 11:12, "And I said unto them, if ye think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. Now, the words of Judas, the one who betrayed him, spoken here several centuries before, telling how he could be dickering with those priests. He would tell them, "All right, you give me what I ask, or I won't betray him." You come over to the New Testament, you read the story there of how, as Judas dickered with those priests, he put his demand to them, and they reached in the bag and counted out 30 pieces of silver for him. Then there was something else. The 13th verse tells what's going to happen to that money. "And the Lord said unto me, cast it unto the potter, a goodly price that I was prized out of them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter in the house of the Lord." Now, friends, here's what happened in the gospel story. After Judas saw what he had done and saw that Jesus wasn't really going to deliver himself, which he thought Jesus would do, his conscience hurt him enough to come back to those priests and tell them, "Look, I've sinned and that I've betrayed innocent blood." And he threw the 30 pieces of silver at their feet right there in the house of the Lord, like it said he would, and he turned and went out and hanged himself. Now here's another part of the prophecy, and it's quite a problem for these priests. Here's the money lying in front of them. What shall we do with that money? And I can imagine somebody saying, "Well, let's put it in the treasury." Do you know, friends, if they had put that money in the treasury, the Bible would not be true. Jesus would not be the Son of God. That's right. But someone must have said, "Oh no, that's bloody money, money of blood, and we can't put that in the treasury. What shall we do?" And somebody said, "Well, let's buy a potter's field. Let's buy a field out here where we can bury the strangers." So they scooped up the 30 pieces of silver, and they went and bought the potter's field, as the prophet said they would do several hundred years before. Again proving the Bible is true, and that this prediction in the life of Jesus was fulfilled, showing that he was indeed the Son of God. The prophet Isaiah, way back 750 years before the birth of Jesus, said something in Isaiah 50, verse 6. "I gave my back to the smiters and my cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. I hid not my face from shame and spitting." We go to the New Testament, and there we read in Matthew 26:67, that as they heaped insult upon Jesus, some poor wretch went up and spat in his face, just like the prophet had said they would. Again, Isaiah 53:7 tells how he was brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. And we go again to the gospel story in Matthew and notice what happens when Jesus is brought before them and they accuse him falsely. "And when he was accused of the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. Then said Pilate unto him, Hearest thou not how many things they witness against thee? And he answered him never a word, insomuch that the governor marveled greatly." Matthew 27:12-14. Now here Jesus stands before that howling mob, and they're bringing all sorts of railing accusations against him. And Jesus answered never a word. He was silent. Anyone else would have screamed out and told them of the lies they were telling against him. In Isaiah 53:12, it talks about two or three other things that would happen. "Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, And he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he hath poured out his soul unto death. And he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bare the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors. Now, you know the gospel story. It tells us that when they brought him up to that place of crucifixion on Golgotha's hill, they laid the cross down and stretched him out on it. The hammer and the nails were brought, and as they raised that hammer and drove those cruel spikes through those tender, quivering hands and feet, Jesus looked up and said, "Father, forgive them. They know not what they do." They don't realize they're nailing the Son of God to this cross. "Father, forgive them. Lay not this to their charge." Now, the prophet had said he would pray for them 750 years earlier. And there on the cross, as they were nailing him, he prays that their sin may be forgiven to them. That Friday afternoon, after they had nailed him to the cross, the multitude was looking on and the soldiers were getting ready to go away. Here were the garments of Jesus, and it was a custom that the soldiers who did the work of crucifying would be the ones who would take whatever he had. If you had been there, probably right after noon, you would have seen that little group of soldiers clustered over to the side. They had divided his clothing, but now they had come to his vesture, to that cloak, which was a seamless garment, and they didn't know what to do with that one piece. "Shall we cut it into four pieces and give each soldier a fourth?" If they had, my friends, he would not have been the Son of God, because the prophet had said 1,000 years before that they would not be tearing it apart or cutting it apart. It said that they would cast dice to see who would get it. "They part my garments among them and cast lots upon my vesture." So there they shoot the dice, and one of them gets a garment and the other three don't. Just like the Bible said it would happen. You read it for yourself in John 19, 23 and 24. Again, the psalmist also predicted back there in Psalm 69, 21, how they would offer him vinegar to drink as he hung there on the cross. "They gave me also gall for my meat and in my thirst." And that one of the soldiers took a sponge, dipped it in vinegar, and put it to his lips to quench his thirst. But Jesus didn't drink it, because he didn't want anything to benumb his senses. He was suffering. He was dying for the sins of the world, and he needed to know what was happening. But the prophecy was fulfilled, as you read again in John 19. Then, back to Isaiah again, 750 years before his death, a prophet predicted about his death and the tomb in which he would be buried. Isaiah 53:9 says, "He made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, because he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth." And you read the gospel story there in John again, how the rich man, Joseph of Arimathea, had a tomb at the foot of the hill in which never man had lain, and he begged the body of Jesus. Pilate gave it to him, and they took it down, placed it in that tomb at the foot of the hill, and there Jesus was entombed in a wealthy man's grave, just like the prophet said 750 years earlier. I tell you, friends, it even says that no bone of his body would be broken. It even says how his hands and feet would be pierced. And that was long before the process of crucifixion was ever known about. And now this is Joe Cruz saying goodbye for today.